probability estimated at 84.3%. The Tholian assembly took out the monitor, and they did it in a way so we wouldn't know it was them. Burnham laid out the plain facts of it. Saru was right all along. We need to contact Starfleet Command. If the Tholians are on the move again, if they're testing our resolve, this could be the precursor to an expansion of their borders. We have to be cautious and... Giorgio was cut off as a warning tone sounded over the Shenzhou's intercom system. What now?
All hands, yellow alert, called the first officer's voice. Captain, report to the bridge.
Burnham and Giorgio exchanged a grave look as the captain crossed to the intercom panel.
Report, number one.
Long-range sensors have picked up a large vessel on an intercept course, said the Andorian. It will be within weapons range in 9 minutes.
Giorgio looked away. Is it Tholian?
Unknown. But whatever it is, it's coming in fast.
8. When they re-entered the cargo modules, Saru sensed immediately that something had changed. Before, the prickle of the Gorlan sensory fields had washed over him like the current of a river, moving about the Kelpian as if he were a stone in their path around which they had to flow. Now it was different. The auras were shaded toward more subtle nuance and finer detail. There was less of the brute force emotional content he had sensed before, and in its place, there was a kind of strange anticipatory air. Like the world around me is holding its breath, he thought. Saru frowned, walking slowly to keep pace with Vetch and the others, thinking back to what he had said before to Captain Giorgio about the Gorlan aura field. It was difficult to put into words for a being who had never experienced such a thing. How would one explain colors to someone whose eyes could only perceive in monochrome? Saru could think of it as music, or as the rush of wind through trees, an effect that lay beneath everything, on which dialogue and unity could rise or fall. The Gorlans walking with him seemed to be aware of it too, on some level. As they moved closer to their destination, Saru was sure that he saw them walk a little straighter, unconsciously reflecting the emotional timbre of the atmosphere. This is the circle, he thought. Little wonder their bonds of community are so strong. But part of the Kelpian was fearful as well as fascinated. If this was how the Gorlans were, if their collective gathered will had a common focus, what might happen if it was turned to a darker end? The Paliar engineer Hekan had spoken of those who called the Gorlans violent and primitive. Did those rumors have a grain of truth in them? A thought formed as Saru examined the prospect. There was another possibility, and the more he considered it, the more it seemed to fit the facts at hand. Saru could actively sense the aura fields of the Gorlans, and he imagined that, given enough time and cooperation, it might even have been possible for the Kelpian to learn to communicate with the aliens without the use of a universal translator device. A species like humans would never be able to bridge that gap without a technological aid, their more limited senses forever deaf to the ephemeral, additional component to the Gorlan language. Saru could sense the aura and be fully aware of it. But what if the Paliars sensed it too? Their physiology is certainly comparable, he thought. Saru would need to conduct a full tricorder scan to be sure, but even a cursory visual examination could pick out the telltale cranial structures on the Paliars where clusters of epithelial cells existed, suggesting that they were beings with a very basic, instinctive electroreceptivity. Saru's theory snapped into sharp focus. What if the Paliars unconsciously sense the auras of the Gorlans, but on a level so subtle they are unaware of it? He thought about the unease that Hekan had shown toward them, the anger exhibited by Nathal. Could those be emotional reactions stirred by proximity? All their biases and fears quietly magnified? He tried to put himself in the place of the insular defensive Paliars. If his theory was right, it would go a long way toward understanding why they instinctively felt the need to reject the Gorlands. Finally, the group reached the gathering place where Saru had made his first unplanned contact, and they halted. The small open square emptied as they approached, the few Gorlands milling around in it immediately dissipating as Saru drew nearer. No one spoke. No one made a sound or a sign to tell the others to leave. They simply departed of their own accord, melting into shadows, disappearing through tent flaps or around makeshift walls. It was disconcerting.
"Wait here," Kijo told him, breaking the silence. "If she wishes to know you, she will come to you. If not, then this will go no further."
The pilot bowed her head and walked away. She had only taken a few steps when she stopped suddenly and looked back.
"Did you bring a token?"
"A what?" He blinked at the question. Kijo sighed.
"It doesn't matter. You don't know our ways. Perhaps it won't be expected of you."
She turned and left. Saru watched the other Gorlands move away, unsure what would happen next. Mado was the last to go, and before he did, he pointed at Saru with one hand and up into the gloomy hull spaces above with another.
"Look there. Do you see?"
The Kelpian squinted, his eyes adjusting swiftly. He could make out a shape, a small figure crouching in the dark where a nexus of support cables came together in a heavy bundle.
"She doesn't know,"
Mado went on, his voice dropping to a whisper.
"Not everything. Not about all of the steps we take to protect her. It is better that way."
Up there, Saru saw that the crouching figure was holding something. Light glittered off the keen edge of an arrowhead, knocked and ready to be released. The tip moved as he moved, tracking him.
"Understand?" said Mado. "If you try to hurt her, threaten her, if you make any sudden moves, anything that marks you as a danger."
The Gorlan reached up and put a thick finger on the flesh of Saru's throat. "That is not my intention," Saru said stiffly.
"Good."
The Gorlan took a deep breath and looked around. The gruff, bellicose manner he had exhibited up on the command deck was gone. He seemed calmer, almost sorrowful.
"What you are being granted is an honor. Prove you are worthy of it, Outworlder."
Then, at length, Mado turned and walked off, vanishing in the half-dark like all the rest of them. Saru waited patiently, shifting from hoof to hoof, unsure if he should remain in the same spot. Time passed, an hour perhaps, and at last he dared to take a few steps, peering up into the gloom. No swift arrow came whistling out of the blackness to bury itself in his neck, so he decided to take that as a sign he was free to move around. A faint floral odor reached his nostrils, and Saru cautiously followed it to its source. In the center of the open area was a repurposed thermal radiator casting out a low simmer of warmth. He hadn't noticed it before. Atop it was a metal flask with a wispy pennant of pale steam escaping from a vent in the lid. Saru moved closer. The flask appeared to be brewing a heated solution of tisane, and unconsciously his mouth watered. Odd, he thought. The smell was totally new to him, and yet Saru's first compulsion was to want to drink some of the brew.
"I have brought cups," said a musical voice.
He heard her footsteps, the shuffling gait of the distorted leg as she stepped and half-dragged it. Saru shifted to face the Gorlan female in the white robes. She seemed very small to him, hardly larger than an immature humanoid child. Her face, though, her eyes, there was an age to them, and a gracefulness that reminded the Kelpian of Philippa Georgiou. At once, he felt a sense of trust move through him. "Are you doing that?" he asked, waving a hand in the air as if trying to catch a handful of the aura sense. Are you trying to set me at ease? The question seemed to confuse her.
You may as well ask me if I am breathing, if I am living.
The moment passed, and she smiled.
Saru, welcome back.
She nodded at the modified UT clipped to his uniform.
It's good we finally have a way to talk without the barriers of our diverse natures falling between us.
Gathering her white robes up, she picked her way across the makeshift decking to the radiator pad and found a place to sit. She seemed so delicate, her limbs thin, her body stiff. Saru watched her, let her take her time about it.
You are what the others think of as the hub, he ventured.
She sighed.
The center of the circle. It does sound so very serious, doesn't it?
She gestured to the flask.
Could you get that? Do be careful. It's hot.
Saru did as she asked, bringing the steaming container down to her level. He placed it within arm's reach and backed off.
What do I call you?
Ija was the name I was born with,
she said, as she poured out two generous measures into the battered metal cups she held in one hand.
You're welcome to use it. I don't have much call to. After I was lifted, it wasn't important anymore.
Lifted?
The term seemed out of place. Her head bobbed.
Yes. The ones like me, we have a role to play.
She patted her twisted leg with one hand and tapped her brow with another.
The Creator withers us in one way, empowers us in another. As in all things, there has to be balance.
I think I understand.
Again, Saru wanted very badly to submit Ija to a deep biomedical scan with a tricorder. What are the odds I would see a loss in bodily mobility combined with a marked increase in the size of her brain's electroreceptive organs? She sat back and studied the two cups, but made no move to offer him one.
So, did you bring me a token?
He swallowed hard. Is that your custom? I am sorry. I don't have...
Saru trailed off. He didn't want to offend the Gorlands.
And then an idea occurred to him. Wait, no. Yes, I do. He reached up and took off his Starfleet insignia. This?
She held out a hand, and he dropped the badge into her palm.
Ija seemed delighted by the offering, running her fingers along the curves of the silver Delta shield.
I like it. What do these things mean?
She touched the raised dots indicating Saru's rank, then the etching on the reverse side showing his name and serial number. He explained the significance, and she seemed pleased, the insignia vanishing into the folds of her grubby white robes. In return, she pushed a cup of tisane toward him. Saru waited for Ija to drink first, and then he followed suit. The flavor was bittersweet, not unpleasant, but lacking something.
You don't like the taste?
She asked.
It needs salt, he said.
Ah, I will remember for next time.
Ija mirrored his careful sip and gave him a solemn look.
And so, with this sharing of my vital fluids, you and I are now betrothed, Saru of Starfleet.
What? All the color drained from the Kelpian's face in a cold rush. He raised his hand, questioningly.
I am very fertile, so I will bear a large brood from our copulation,
she went on.
Afterward, our children and I will consume your flesh, as is our way.
What? He repeated, shocked, rigid. Saru's threat ganglia crawled at the back of his head, squirming so much they seemed to be trying to break off and escape. In the next second, Ija was making the same rough chugging noise that Saru had recognized earlier from Mado. She was laughing.
But in this case, the sound was warm and inclusive instead of harsh and mocking. She held up the cup and gave him a wide, toothy smile.
Forgive me, I am teasing you. It's just a drink, nothing more.
Ija leaned in to share a confidence.
I have heard there are beings who serve in Starfleet that have no sense of humor at all.
Two of her hands came up and made the shapes of points at the tips of her ears.
Is that true?
It is, he agreed, an unashamed relief flooding through him. They are called Vulcans.
Vulcans.
Ija tried out the word.
I'd like to meet one. Have you met one?
Saru recalled Michael Burnham's face and the telltale arch of her eyebrow when she posed a challenge to him.
In a way. It is a strange concept for me to process, admitted Ija. My life would be desolate without laughter. But I imagine these Vulcans are like us, Saru, yes? We are the sum of our natures. We are all on the path that our birthright sets out for us.
I'm not sure if I agree, he replied, taking another sip of tisane. I took a different path from the one I was born into.
Did you?
Ija smiled again.
Or did you just find the way to the path that had been right for you all along?
She paused.
I am Gorlan. What form are you, Saru?
My species is known as Kelpian. The others who came with me to this ship are humans, a Maserite, Baksha, and a Zano.
So many.
Ija's eyes widened.
Is it difficult for you to be united on your ship and in your federation?
We disagree on some things, he admitted, and he saw she was opening a door for him. But what we agree on far outweighs those concerns. I hope we can do the same with your people.
And the Paliars?
All of us. Ija sighed.
I wanted that too, but they haven't made it easy.
She shook her head.
They don't see what is coming.
Saru's brow furrowed as he considered the words. Was she speaking about the hijacking of the freighter, or something else? The Federation and Starfleet, our duty is to the preservation of life.
Mine is to my people, she replied. Do you understand what I am to them?
Ija nodded in the direction of the silent dwellings all around the open atrium.
My people believe my gifts are the embodiment of our Creator's will. I am a living conduit to that faith. Do you see?
The words were in Ija's voice, but she did not speak them aloud. The shape of them was abruptly present in the front of Saru's thoughts, forming out of nothing. He couldn't help himself. He jerked back in shock and knocked over the metal cup, sending what was left of the tisane across the metal decking. Too late to stop himself, Saru flicked his head up, searching for the archer above, fearful of what would come next. Ija raised one hand in the direction of the shadows overhead.
No. Oh, you've spilled it. Let me pour you some more.
She gave a brittle smile and set the cup upright before carefully refilling it.
I am sorry, Saru. I didn't mean to frighten you.
You're a telepath.
Is that your word for my gift?
She made a shrugging motion and handed him back his cup.
I've never been able to define it. I've always thought I was just more aware of things than others around me.
Saru worked to contain his reaction, gripping the cup firmly.
Is there something in this? He wondered. Something affecting my mind?
He was well aware of the existence of psionic ability in some species, but he had never encountered it directly. The communication Ija had sent to him was so strong, so clear, he couldn't help but wonder what else she was capable of. She became sad.
Ah, I have overstepped. Now you don't trust me.
It isn't that. He took a breath. It was unexpected. Saru looked around. Is that why Mado seemed different when we came down here? Are you affecting him?
Yes, she admitted, but not in the way you think. I can only project. I cannot read others. And what I do is not coercion, not something I can force on you.
You spoke to me.
That is only possible when I am very near to a person, and if they are open to it. If you don't wish to hear me, you won't.
Ija gave a long sigh.
It is a great effort to communicate that way. But my mind is unfettered, Saru, even as my body is a withered thing. This is the Creator's will, so that I am kept humble. I do not question it.
Saru's thoughts raced. They call you the Hub, because you bring unity. Am I correct?
I was lifted after my birth. In every community, those like me come once in a generation, and we are brought into being to guide our brothers and sisters.
She tapped a finger on the middle of her brow.
I bring them clarity. I help them work as one.
Does every Gorlan colony have a Hub?
Yes. There are old stories of a before time, when the Creator's face was turned from us and the Gorlans had little harmony with one another. There was no circle then, only discord.
Saru considered that. You command them. Is that it?
No. If that were possible, I would never have allowed Mado to take up arms against the Paliars.
Ija looked into her cup.
I provide focus and insight.
She looked up and one of her hands clasped Saru's.
That is why it is important we speak. I have to warn you about what is coming. The Paliars do not hear me, but I think you will.
There are things I have seen.
The silent voice pressed into his thoughts again, and Saru instinctively resisted it. He forced himself to relax and allow it to continue.
When I dream, I see pathways, futures.
How?
Everyone around me is moving in different ways, cutting paths, making ripples.
Ija swirled the tisan in her cup.
When you exist at the center of all that, you begin to see patterns. They vary, but as time passes they collapse toward a single eventuality. I've dreamed things, Saru.
A world made of ash. Destruction falling on threads of fire.
The form of the words and the imagery propelled them into Saru's awareness with an almost physical force. He reeled, struggling to process it. He gasped and held up his hands. They were shaking. Please, stop. It's overwhelming.
I am sorry,
repeated Ija, reaching up to wipe tears from her eyes.
But I need you to understand. This is why they protect me with such desperate dedication, Saru. And this is my attempt to protect them.
The Kelpian was still trying to comprehend what he had just experienced when he became aware of figures approaching from the shadows. Mado, Kijo, and the other Gorlans drew to a reverent distance and waited there.
You have to go,
said Ija, rising unsteadily to her feet. Despite himself, Saru automatically reached out and helped her up.
We are here,
she added. Where is... He began to ask the question, but fell silent as a rumbling tone echoed through the hull of the massive starship. The constant mutter of the vessel's drives faded. They were dropping out of warp.
The sanctuary world designated by the Paliars.
She turned her back on him. Other Gorlans appeared to crowd around Ija and spirit her away.
You will see.
Saru turned as Mado approached. His gaze trailed after the hub as she vanished behind the flaps of a darkened yurt.
"It seems she thought you were worthy," he muttered.
"Few are," added Kijo.
She carried a glassy datapad in one hand and held it up.
"This is a relay from the sensors up on the command tier. We have reverted to impulse drives, and the autonomic navigation is vectoring us to a nearby planet."
She offered it to him, and he took it.
"You spoke to her," Mado grated. "So now you know what is at stake. She is precious to us."
He jabbed a fist at the Kelpian.
"I need you to do what you promised."
But Saru did not reply. He stared at the image on the datapad, a long-range visual of the star freighter's final destination. It was a dark and uninviting sphere wreathed in streams of gray-white cloud, broken up by small, colorless oceans surrounding pallid, barren landmasses. "A world made of ash," he thought. Burnham dashed onto the Shenzhou's bridge and into a carefully controlled maelstrom of activity. At every station, the starship's command crew were fully engaged in preparations to meet the unidentified alien vessel. From the corner of her eye, she saw Cameron Gant running through the available offensive and defensive systems, and he briefly met her gaze. Gant didn't need to say it. With the damage Shenzhou had suffered still being repaired, they were in no shape for a fight.
"Let's hope it doesn't come to that,"
Burnham told herself as Captain Georgiou took the center seat.
"Lieutenant, take Science Station 2," said her commander, indicating the console with a nod of her head.
As Burnham followed the order, Georgiou glanced up at her first officer who stood nearby.
"Give me the count, Number One."
"Target vessel will be on us in less than 2 minutes," said the Andorian. "They show no signs of slowing, Captain. It looks like a combative approach."
"Are they trying to make us flinch?"
Georgiou straightened in her seat.
"Ensign Fan, any contact on subspace?"
"Negative,"
reported the communications officer.
"Captain, we've been hailing them on all channels since they entered range. They're not responding. There's no way they're not hearing us."
"Rude," noted Georgiou. She looked back at Burnham.
"Sweep the craft. Tell me what we have."
Burnham had anticipated the captain's orders and already started a comparative analysis of the incoming ship against known designs in the Federation's database. Her first answer was the one she imagined everybody on the bridge was waiting for.
"It's not a Tholian design. Power curves, warp matrix emissions are all way off that baseline."
"We need to know what it is, not what it isn't," snapped Chitelo. "Details, Lieutenant."
"Yes, sir."
Her hands danced over the controls, and in seconds, the potential origins of the craft narrowed down to a single high percentile probability.
"I want to see what we're dealing with," Georgiou was saying. "Yanuzi, give me a visual and magnify."
The ops officer tapped in a command and part of the main bridge port rippled, becoming a viewscreen. The other vessel lurched closer as the view stabilized and the craft was revealed. A crescent moon shape, approaching them on a vertically oriented plane, it rose up like the blade of a vast curved sword ready to be dropped in a swift executioner's blow. 4 warp nacelles, 2 at either end of the structure, glowed purple-white as it started to bleed off its approach speed.
"Tonnage has to be at least twice, maybe 3 times ours," offered Ensign Detmer.
"We don't have this design in our memory bank," Burnham reported, shaking off the grim mental image of the ship as a weapon.
"But sensors are picking out emission vectors from onboard systems that match those of the Pilliar Zell freighter."
"A warship," said Chitelo. "Come looking for its lost compatriot?"
"Still bearing down on us," called Gant. "Slowing now, but with a very aggressive posture."
"Captain, we should go to red alert," said the first officer. "We can't afford to be hit again."
"No one is clearer on that than I am," Georgiou said briskly. "We hold."
Then she threw a look toward the tactical station.
"But be ready, Mr. Gant."
Count on it, Captain, said the lieutenant.
Burnham guessed that after the surprise attack they had suffered earlier, Cameron would not let the Shenzhou be caught unprotected for a second time. Her panel chimed a warning tone, and Burnham's attention switched back to it.
Sensors are reading an aspect change on the target. It's shifting attitude.
She halted. That wasn't all there was to it, though. All down the length of the craft, new blooms of energy were appearing beneath the outer hull. On the screen, the still-slowing vessel performed a 90-degree roll into a horizontal position, and across its surface, multiple hatches irised open one after another.
"What is it doing?" Burnham heard Ensign Troke ask from the other science station.
"They're deploying something," she said. "Thrusters are firing."
As one, a dozen bullet-shaped objects burst out of the open silos along the length of the other ship's hull and swarmed together into a geometric formation. Ensign Yanuzi tracked one of the objects with the visual feed, and it grew distinct. Burnham recognized it at once. The same projectile-like fuselage, ventral engine nacelle, and twin solar array of a Pelear escort drone.
"The, carrier has come to a dead stop," reported Gant. "Drones are moving to intercept us."
"Detmer, put some distance between us and them," said the captain.
"Trying," replied the helmswoman.
"But they're gaining on us."
"If we had a warp drive, we could leave them eating our ion wake."
The first officer didn't bother to finish the sentence. On her panel, Burnham saw the same thing the Andorian did. The drones were splitting apart, spreading wide.
"Captain, I think they're trying to surround us."
"All right, we've been polite enough," said Giorgio.
"Red alert! Battle stations!"
"Battle stations, aye,"
repeated Gant, and across the bridge, the illuminator panels in the walls flashed to a stark crimson shade.
"Calm," continued the captain. "Warn them that if they don't back off, we will consider it an act of open aggression and defend ourselves."
She looked back at the helm.
"Detmer, evasive maneuvers."
"Evasive, aye,"
said the ensign, and the starscape outside shifted as they went into a hard impulse turn.
"We can't outrun them."
The thought escaped Burnham's lips as she watched the drones breaking into smaller packs, attempting to position themselves at all points around the Shenzhou. One or two of the smaller robotic ships, each armed with a single phase cannon, would have been an easy win for the cruiser in a head-to-head conflict, but this many, acting in concert, represented a grave danger.
"A cloud of dune hornets can bring down a La Macha," she thought.
"Options," said the captain. "And quickly, we're running out of room here."
"Wide-angle phaser salvo," said Chitelo. "We take out a few of the drones, the others might think twice. That or photon torpedoes set to proximity detonation could be enough to blast a hole through the swarm."
He broke off and grabbed the back of the captain's chair to steady himself as the Shenzhou pivoted sharply, faster than the gravity control could compensate. Burnham gripped the sides of her console and rode out the turn. Her eyes were fixed on the screen in front of her.
"They're tightening the noose."
"Thank you for that cheerful analogy, Lieutenant," said Giorgio.
"Detmer?"
"She has a point, Captain," said the helmswoman through gritted teeth. "There's too many of them. It's only a matter of time before they run us down."
"Then we do this another way.
All stop."
The captain stood up.
"Lieutenant Oliveira, divert all available power to shields, if you please."
"Aye, Captain,"
came the reply.
"Let's look them right in the eye."
Burnham watched her commander stride into the middle of the bridge and glare out of the main viewport, past the shifting formation of the drones, to where the carrier craft floated in the darkness.
"We are done playing the role of the hunted."
"I'll stop," said Detmer. "No forward momentum."
"We're having a staring contest now?"
Chitelo glanced at Burnham, looking for a reply.
"Somehow, sir, I don't think we'll have long to wait."
Burnham had barely finished speaking when a chime sounded from Mary Fan's console.
"Incoming hail from the Pelear carrier," she reported.
And suddenly they're in the mood for a conversation, Giorgio said lightly. Now that they think they have us right where they want us. She stiffened and pulled her uniform straight. All right, Ensign. Put them on. A holographic form shimmered into being in front of the main viewport. An older Paliar male, clad in a dark red ship suit with a silver tunic and an austerely patterned headdress, stepped forward and gave the Shenzhou's crew a withering, chilly once-over.
Federation vessel, he boomed. Lower your shields and prepare to be boarded. Your craft and your crew are deemed in violation of Paliar Zell Cohort Star Law. Defy us, and we will use force.
I'll do nothing until you identify yourself, the captain said mildly, refusing to match his tone. I'll show you how it is done. I am Captain Philippa Giorgio, commander of the Federation starship Shenzhou. We are unaware of any violations.
I am Admiral Tor of the Alphan Defensive Primary, and I will be the arbiter of what you will or will not do, Captain Giorgio.
Tor motioned to someone out of range of his holo transmitter. Burnham saw the sensor sweeps react. Captain, the drones are targeting us. Giorgio acknowledged with a nod. Admiral, you appear to be laboring under a misapprehension. We've done nothing to break any Paliar laws.
We found the wreckage of the escort, Tor seethed. An automated distress call drew us to those coordinates before it was cut off. Did you silence it?
You're talking about the Star Freighter, said the captain.
Our escort obliterated, our ship missing, and what else do I discover? An ion trail leading to a rogue Starfleet vessel disrespecting our borders. I will have the truth from you.
Cold, stony anger radiated from the Paliar Admiral's manner, enough that Burnham felt it like frost in the air. I'm happy to provide it, sir, replied the captain, but not at gunpoint.
You are aliens here. You are in no position to make demands.
He leaned in until his dark, stormy aspect was almost filling the bridge.
My daughter was aboard that transport. Do not doubt I will take any measure in order to ensure her safety.
My people are aboard your missing ship as well, Admiral, said Giorgio. It was a risk to reveal that, thought Burnham, but it might also be the only chance she had to establish a rapport with the stone-faced Paliar commander. Why don't we take our hands off our weapons and talk about how we can get them back. Tor's silence seemed to stretch forever, but then the Admiral flicked a hand toward his subordinates once more, and on her screen, Burnham saw the targeting sweeps from the drone blink out.
I warn you, Captain Giorgio, growled Tor. If you have answers I find lacking, it will not go well for you. And no agreements between politicians on your worlds or mine will temper my response.
The hologram vanished, and no one spoke. Finally, Troy Yanuzi broke the silence. Can I stop holding my breath now? Giorgio turned away, catching Burnham's eye as she did. I'm afraid, Ensign, that we're just getting started. In silence, they gathered around the captain's station on the upper level of the Paliar freighter's command deck, watching the images streaming to the curved screens suspended from frames overhead. Saru stood at the back of the group of Gorlans, conscious of his own presence among them. He felt like an interloper at a wake, at once able to understand the emotions churning around him and disconnected from the ones they affected. But Mado and his red bands, Kijo and the others, all of them, were looking down at the dark endpoint to the lies they had been told about the so-called sanctuary world. As the freighter's auto-navigator began to settle it onto a stable geostationary orbit, the nature of the planet beneath was revealed in full. Saru used the tricorder the Gorlands had allowed him to keep to parse the feed from the ship's sensor array, rendering the data into Federation standard. What he saw reflected there gave him pause. The planet was just barely on the right side of habitable, clinging to the definition of a Class M world. The atmosphere was thin but breathable, the gravity high but tolerable. But few could look upon it and not see a harsh, desolate place bereft of any kind of comfort. Much of the surface registered as composed of black metallic sand, broken up by high mountainous regions and the thin oceans. Native flora and fauna were sparse, and powerful storm cells swept with alarming regularity from pole to pole. Perhaps, with time and the application of advanced technology to terraform the surface, this planet might have been able to bloom. But as it was right now, Saru could only see a bleak wilderness where long-term survival would be a constant challenge, even to a species as hardy as the Gorlands.
"This is where they chose to abandon us," said one of the red bands,
quiet shock in his words.
"Are there any other ships in the system?"
Mado shot Kijo a questioning glance, and in turn, she looked towards Saru. The Kelpian frowned, tapping into the sensors once again.
"Scanning range is limited. As far as I can see, this is the only craft in near-orbital space."
A cluster of blips flickered into existence as the sensor sweep passed over the surface of the sanctuary world, and he studied them closely.
"Curious. I am detecting evidence of starship-grade metals on the planet, tritanium and other alloys."
Kijo moved to one of the vacant consoles and mirrored the same data to it.
"Saru is correct. Several clusters on the southern continent. Here, and here."
She pointed out groups of signals in an area of flatlands close to the foot of a mountain range.
"Something crashed?" said Mado.
"No. Those are cargo modules."
Saru ran a quick comparison to the container pods fitted to the spine of the star freighter. "They are of Pelear origin. It looks like they soft-landed."
"Life signs," said
Kijo, switching the sensor view over to a different scan filter. A myriad of data points filled the zones around the downed pods, each one indicating a living being down on the surface. The closer he looked, the more Saru could pick out elements of what appeared to be a shantytown settlement built up around the grounded cargo modules.
"All Gorlan," added Kijo. "No Pelears detected."
"How many?"
Mado bit out the words.
"Approximately 200,000.
Kijo went pale.
"Thank the Creator! We have found our people!"
"What is left of them?" said Mado.
He glared at Saru.
"You see, Kelpian, here is the truth. The ships the Pelears sent before this one, coming to this barren ember to cast us away. This is the reality of their false promises."
"How could we live in such desolation?"
Kijo asked the question to the air.
"The weakest of us could never survive down there."
Saru thought of Ija, the hub, and her delicate form. That place would end her, he realized. And then another, more troubling thought rose to eclipse that one. If this was the world of ash that she had predicted, then what of her other warning? Could Ija's extra-normal abilities encompass something as incredible as precognition? As a being of rational and scientific thought, Saru found the concept difficult to process. But still, the Kelpian's blood ran cold at the dark possibilities her words represented. Destruction on threads of fire. Across the command deck, the elevator platform clanked open and the speaker Vetch emerged, along with a pack of armed Gorlands and a handful of the Pelear crew. Saru saw Commander Nathal among them, and at her side, the second officer Hekan and the engineer named Raiden.
"What do you want with us now?" demanded Nathal.
I swear to you we will die before we help you.
I want you to answer for your deceit, said Mado,
shoving Saru aside as he strode across to meet the Pelear captain. He waved two arms toward the gray-black, ashen planet on the viewscreen.
Pelear Zell promised us a refuge. You gave us no choice but to leave, and we agreed!
We agreed, because you Alphans and Betans told us the Sanctuary would support our people.
Kijo's voice was thick with emotion, and Saru sensed a powerful wave of abject despair radiating from her.
Look at it!
Look at it!
Bellowed Mado, and he grabbed Nathal, shoving her violently toward the scanner screen. Nathal shook him off and glared at the monitor.
What is this? This isn't the Sanctuary, you fools! The Commander does not lie,
Hekan called out.
I've seen the colonial reports for the refuge world. It's a verdant, abundant place. You did something to my ship. You did something wrong, snarled Nathal,
and she turned her ire on Saru.
You helped them, Starfleet? We came out of warp in the wrong place.
I assure you, I did nothing, Saru said stiffly. And no alterations to your vessel's course were made. He showed her the control console. Even as we speak, this ship is still acting under the autonomic controls that your crew activated. Saru nodded toward Raiden, who watched silently from across the compartment.
That is not possible!
Nathal pushed past the Kelpian to see for herself. She jabbed at the console, bringing up the navigation subsystem. The freighter's line of transit redrew itself across the local star map for Nathal, and as Saru watched the realization dawning on the Pelear commander, he saw the fight drain out of her.
This is wrong,
she repeated, but now her words were hollow and distant.
They told us where we were taking you. There would be a fair chance.
Lies, and lies, and lies, hissed Mado. Is that all your kind know, Pelear?
Without warning, a bright blue alert sigil flashed into life across all of the command deck's visual displays. Saru heard a strident, echoing bell tone, very different from the warning siren that had met him when he first boarded the transport ship. What is that? A long, lingering groan of metal on metal sounded through the hull of the huge vessel, and on the screens, pre-programmed thruster controls were coming online to adjust the ship's orbital attitude. It entered a slow roll, shifting to present its ventral hull to the planet.
The cargo modules, said Hekan in a dead voice. That's the release cycle. When it is complete, they will be ejected from the ship.
Down to the planet, said Saru, looking back at the cluttered surface scan. 9. The humming cascade of rematerialization rippled over Burnham's skin as it dissipated, and she experienced that familiar abrupt shift in location that was peculiar to beaming. The octagonal panels of the Pelear transporter pad glowed brightly beneath her feet, and it took a second for her eyes to adjust. The Starfleet standard gravity and environment of the Shenzhou was replaced by the atmosphere of the Pelear carrier's interior space, and she attuned quickly, shifting her weight. The air in the alien ship had a faintly spicy quality to it, and she wondered if that was unique to the vessel or something to remind the crew of their homeworlds. Burnham filed the thought away. Each time she encountered a species she had never met before, her curiosity to learn more about them pushed to the fore. But this was not the time to conduct a survey, obviously or not. She was, and her captain with her, very much in harm's way.
Thank you for allowing us to board your vessel, Admiral Tall.
At Burnham's side, Captain Georgiou described a shallow bow of greeting. I hope we can settle this matter amicably. She went to step off the pad, but Taw raised his hand.
Remain where you are. This conversation will be a short one.
Tall had been waiting for them in the large open compartment the Pelears had set up for the meeting. Burnham guessed it was a storage bay of some kind, a wide chamber with a raised, ring-shaped catwalk overhead. A couple of his crew, most likely officers judging by the headdresses they wore, flanked Taw silently, and above, on the walkway, she saw armed security guards cradling stubby disruptor weapons. The Admiral was taking no chances with them.
"Who is this?"
Taw asked, pointing at her.
"Lieutenant Michael Burnham, one of my junior officers," explained Georgiou. "My second-in-command insisted that I not come over here alone."
The captain, as usual, was downplaying things. Commander Chithalo had turned ocean dark when Georgiou told him she was going to beam over to meet with the Admiral, and in the end she had made it an order for the XO to remain where he was. Burnham could picture him pacing the Shenzhou's bridge, ready for even the slightest sign of duplicity from the Pelears.
"You allow your subordinates to influence you that much," sniffed the Pelear, glancing at his own executive officer. "My adjutant Crea here suggested I meet with you with all the formality and warmth of a diplomatic welcome. But then, he is from Beta Moon, and our Betan cousins are sometimes soft-hearted. I rejected such a show of obvious sycophancy."
The captain gave the lieutenant a brief look. Back in the ship, Burnham had asked her why she was taking her along instead of someone like Zuzub, or one of the more imposing-looking security officers.
"This situation doesn't need someone who's quick with a phaser," she replied. "It needs someone observant."
Burnham took a breath of the spiced air and resolved to see everything and ignore nothing. "I owe you an explanation," Georgiou went on. "My ship is outside of its patrol zone, that is true. We are within a sector of space that is claimed by a number of stellar powers, but I have a good reason."
"You're missing crew," said Taw with a grimace, "if we are to believe you."
He cocked his head, examining the Shenzhou's commander.
"I will tell you now in the interests of clarity. I have reason to suspect you entered our space on a mission of provocation."
"Our purpose here is altruistic," Georgiou countered. "But I will admit, it has pulled us into a situation that we did not anticipate."
"Where is my daughter's vessel?"
Taw's patience was thinning, but both the captain and the lieutenant caught the reveal.
"Does he mean Nathal?"
Burnham considered the possibility. Now that she thought about it, there was some familial similarity between the Admiral and the acerbic commander of the Star Freighter.
"We don't know for certain," began Georgiou. "Our first inkling that something was amiss came when my ship detected a subspace pulse effect at long range. The captain provided a quick but thorough précis of the events that had transpired over the last few days. The Nadion pulse, the rescue operation, the suspected hijacking of the transport, the surprise attack on the Shenzhou, and resulting damage to its warp drives. She made no mention of Saru's behavior or her own terse conversation with Nathal. "Like father, like daughter,"
thought Burnham, recalling the commander's manner. She could see where Nathal had learned her brisk and uncompromising methods. Once or twice during her explanation, Taw's subordinate Crea had reacted to Georgiou's statements and tried to interrupt, but the Admiral silenced him with a hard jerk of the wrist each time. Still, by the time the captain was done, Taw's expression had turned thunderous.
"This would not have happened if you had not interfered,"
he said, cold fury seething beneath the words.
"What gives you the right?"
"Lives were in danger."
Burnham said it without thinking, and then it was too late to take it back.
"We had to act."
Taw turned his full attention on the lieutenant for the first time.
"Your officer speaks out of turn," he said.
"She does," Georgiou admitted. "I encourage it."
"And now this situation is spiraling out of control," he went on. "Your ill-considered good intentions have escalated a problem that was ours to deal with. Do you understand that, Captain?"
Georgiou's tone cooled.
"Your daughter,
her crew, and the Gorlan refugees aboard that vessel are alive because of Starfleet intentions, sir. I won't apologize for that. Taw advanced a step toward them, glaring at Georgiou.
Of course not. The Federation's arrogance is legendary. You think you can do no wrong, and it galls me that some foolish Baetans believe we are better off under your banner than on our own.
He made a negative noise in the back of his throat, shooting a brief, withering look at his own officer.
You come here to our space with little understanding of the delicate balance of things, and you interfere.
A brittle note entered the Admiral's voice, and Burnham caught it. She got the sense that there was more to this than just the Pelear's wounded pride and a father's concern for his child. Step back, she told herself. Consider the whole. Think of what you know of these people and ask yourself, what is he really afraid of?
You do not live in this place, Taw was saying. You and the other outworlders, you pass through. And Pelear Zell must deal with what comes in your wake.
She had it then, the element that she had been missing. Burnham gave her captain a sideways look, and Georgiou inclined her head, granting permission. Admiral, if I may ask, when was the last time the Pelear cohort encountered a Tholian ship in this area? It was as if the temperature in the compartment had instantly dropped 10 degrees. Burnham saw Taw stiffen at the mention of the alien threat, and his mask of belligerence briefly slipped. Beneath it, she glimpsed someone on edge, fearful of what unknown dangers the Tholian assembly represented.
We stay out of their way, he said at length. Only a fool would draw their attention.
And you are afraid that the presence of a Starfleet vessel will do that? She made it a statement, not a question.
I was not granted command of a ship like this because I blunder into battles that cannot be won, Taw retorted, covering his lapse. I understand the realities of the situation, unlike you.
If that is so, said Georgiou, then you know that the Tholians are always watching. And whatever they choose to do, neither Pelear Zell nor the Federation will get a say in it.
My standing orders, Captain, are to ensure we give them no pretext and to maintain the security of my people.
He aimed a thick, gloved finger at her.
Your presence risks both of those things.
Taw took a breath.
You said you were following the freighter. Where was it heading?
Their course was taking them toward an uncharted system near Demora's.
Georgiou folded her arms across her chest.
We tracked the ship's ion trail, but without warp drive, we couldn't catch up to them.
Taw exchanged glances with Crea.
No matter how we try to solve it, the Gorlan problem continues to waylay us. This time they have gone too far.
He turned away.
Go back to your ship, Captain, and return to your Federation.
We are in non-aligned space, sir, replied the Shenzhou's commander. Pelear Zell does not have sole right of authority here.
He ignored her, speaking directly to his men.
Adjutant, recall the drones and ready the ship. There can be only one place they are heading. Set a course for the sanctuary.
As you order, Admiral, said
Crea, and he tapped a button on a wrist-mounted control device.
Let us come with you!
Burnham blurted out the words, and Taw turned on her.
What do you ask of me now?
Take us with you, she repeated. There are Starfleet officers on your missing ship. It's in our interests to help you find it and deal with this crisis.
I do intend to deal with it, Taw said firmly.
If not that, then help us complete the repairs on our warp drive, said Georgiou, sensing an opportunity. The Shenzhou will join you. Our two ships together can bring this matter to a close peacefully.
Again, you are arrogant enough to assume we are of the same mind. I do not seek a peaceful resolution.
He paused, letting that sink in. then gave his subordinates another order.
Leave a pair of drone units behind. They will escort the Shenzhou to the Federation border. By force, if necessary.
What about our officers on the freighter? Demanded Burnham.
We will...